ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. President Biden and the First Lady head to Florida today to survey the damage from Hurricane Idalia. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis says he has no plans to meet with the president. It's expected to be a busy holiday travel weekend. If you haven't hit the road yet, consider
the best and worst times to travel. Today, the heaviest traffic will be between 10 this morning and 6 tonight. For your trip home Monday, AAA says if you don't want to be in the thick of it, travel after 7 p.m.
ABC's Phil Lipoff. Some 14 million Americans expected to be screened at airports this holiday weekend. Singer, songwriter, and restaurateur Jimmy Buffett has died. A statement on his website says he died peacefully, surrounded by family, friends, music, and dogs. He was 76. In the first papal visit to Mongolia ever, Pope Francis celebrating the country's growing Catholic community. Francis praised Mongolia's long history of religious freedom dating back to Genghis Khan. This is ABC News. After a three-year pandemic hiatus, some 43 million federal student loan borrowers are going to see their balances rising again as interest started accruing once again on Friday.
For 33-year-old Ashley Robinson, that pause in payments has been a lifeline, her loan ballooning to $50,000 because of interest. That balance now about to get bigger.
I'm alarmed and I'm nervous. I don't really know where to go from here, to be honest.
The restart of student loan payments next month is a crucial test for Americans' monthly budgets, already strapped by higher borrowing costs for mortgages, credit cards, or car loans after a string of interest rate hikes by the Fed.
It's ABC's Elizabeth Schulze. A federal judge striking down a Texas law requiring age verification and health warnings to view pornographic websites. The judge sided with challengers who say it violates free speech rights and that the law was overbroad and vague. The state's attorney general's office filing a notice of appeal. I'm Mark Remillard, ABC News.
Working hard is a long-standing tradition in Wisconsin. Some of the first labor unions formed here because of it. This Labor Day, join Earl Ingram as he hosts a special The Earl Ingram Show live from 8 to 11 a.m. at Labor Fest in Milwaukee.
Many people don't work on Labor Day, and so all they know is it's a day off. As a person who spent 34 years in labor and was a union man, I know the value of that.
Earl and his guests will discuss how Wisconsin's labor-related legislation became a model for other states, along with what unions look like now.
I've seen us go from that 30% union membership to now in Wisconsin, somewhere around 12%.
A union-led parade meets up with festgoers on the Summerfest grounds at 11. Labor Fest is free and open to all. Join Earl Ingram live this Labor Day, Monday, September 4th, starting at 8 a.m. from Labor Fest in Milwaukee, only here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new study says election denialism, which fosters mistrust in the voting process, could still be a problem in Wisconsin and other battleground states in next year's elections. Mike Mohn reports.
Brian Hinkle is a researcher with the Movement Advancement Project who authored the analysis. He feels election denialism is pushing democracy to the brink of chaos.
Our report shows that 157 million voters currently live in states that are at least moderate risk of election denial, jeopardizing future elections.
Wisconsin faces a moderate threat, and it has come up in the fallout of former President Trump's team being accused of trying to overturn the 2020 vote. The authors highlighted the Badger State because of the close vote here. With Wisconsin having a divided government, enacting safeguards doesn't appear likely. But Hinkle says local administrators can do their part by being as transparent as possible to quell any distrust. And Hinkle says while the 2020 election was nearly 3 years ago, it's clear the fallout hasn't gone away.
The recent indictments charging former President Trump and others with conspiracy to overturn the results of the election, among other crimes, I think highlight both the continuing threat of election denial as well as a potential path for states to hold bad actors accountable.
The report says there are a number of ways states can shield themselves from denialism. That includes laws that protect election officials from threats and block unauthorized access to voting machines. Those suggestions come as Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature push to oust the state's nonpartisan elections director amid lingering rhetoric tied to the 2020 vote. Mike Mohn, Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Do you ever get tired of one-sided conversations? Have you changed the station due to mean-spirited rhetoric? Wouldn't it be refreshing to listen and engage in civilized dialogue about politics and how issues affect our families differently? Welcome to the Rational Revolution. I'm Chris Elfheim.
And I'm Emily Sefos. Together, we'll look at today's issues through a politically purple lens. So join us on Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 on WGBW, WISS, and the Civic Media app.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
This is the Empowered Caregiver Show. If you are a caregiver or know someone who is, this show is meant to uplift you through education and support, while also lifting up every caregiver's invaluable role in society. Now, here is the Empowered Caregiver and your host, Liza Helen Brand.
You are listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show, and I am your host, Liza Helen Brand. Today, my guests are Julie St. Pierre and Jennifer Nowak from the Wisconsin chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. According to the Alzheimer's Association 2023 special report, about 1 in 9 people age 65 and older has Alzheimer's dementia. In Wisconsin, that comes out to an estimated 120,000 people over the age of 65 that are impacted. And the percentage of people with Alzheimer's dementia increases with age. It starts out at about 5% for those between 65 and 74 and increases to about 33% for those 85 and older. And not only are those numbers alarming, but so are the costs and the emotional toll that it takes on the whole family. Thank you so much, Julie and Jennifer, for being here today. So I have about a million questions for you, so I'm just going to jump right in. First, can I have you start by telling listeners your role at the Wisconsin chapter of the Alzheimer's Association and if you have any personal connection with Alzheimer's dementia? And I'll start with Jennifer.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Nowak, and I am a program manager at the Alzheimer's Association. I have a unique role in that I am actually oversee the Family Caregiver Support Programs through Milwaukee County as a part of my role. So I oversee the Alzheimer's Family Caregiver Support Program and the National Family Caregiver Support Program, which is available in Wisconsin in every county.
Oh, wonderful. So you've heard it all.
Yeah. So it's a part of my daily routine, but, and it's such an important, topic, caregiving, especially with the numbers increasing. So I personally, do not have a connection, but I have been involved with, individuals with Alzheimer's since I started in the first memory care unit.
Oh, wow.
1990, I don't want to say.
Sure. That's okay. That you don't have to say. And how about you, Julie?
Okay. Well, my name's Julie St. Pierre. I'm a community outreach coordinator for the Alzheimer's Association. I represent a completely different part of the state than Jennifer does. I'm actually way up north in Rhinelander. So I love the technology that allows us all to be together at the same time as a state. That's really cool. I have been with the Alzheimer's Association for just about 18 years. And in that 18 years, my job has changed a little bit over time. I spend a lot of time working with community partners to address needs within communities, such as education and awareness, and working with different community partners to make sure that those needs are met, especially in our rural parts of the state, way up here, up north. I also work with a great deal of volunteers who facilitate facilitate just a ton of support groups across the northern part of the state as well. Peer-to-peer support is something that's really important to me and love that opportunity to work with families. I also field phone calls that just come in from people who may have general questions about the disease, how to get a diagnosis, what resources available in the community, and really help them identify what could be helpful for them. I will say that when I first started working with the association, I did not have a personal connection to the disease. My background's in recreation therapy, and I just found that I loved working with older adults. I found that everybody continues to play and enjoy their social interactions and recreation, no matter what age they are, and really enjoyed that, found a special love for working with people who have Alzheimer's. But about 12 years ago, my grandma was diagnosed, and then it became very personal. So now it wasn't just something that I was dealing with at work, but now it was something I was assisting my family with as well. We did lose my grandma to Alzheimer's, but I try to make her proud and incorporate a lot of what we learned in caring for her into what I now help and provide as far as education for families who are also affected.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss. Your family must have been so grateful to have you as part of their care team. And thank you for all of the wonderful work that both of you guys do. I wanted just to take a short look at your website. I always like to do that when I have guests on, just to see what's out there. And man, oh man, you could spend forever on your website, just the resources and information. So thank you for making that happen. It has to be comforting for somebody that needs to go there to know that, wow, this is a one-stop shop. So later in the show, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's as it relates to family caregivers. But first, I just wanted to start out with some of the basics. While dementia is a medical condition involving the decline of mental ability, Alzheimer's disease is a specific medical disease within the dementia family. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, making up between 60 and 80% of all dementia cases. What else should we know regarding the differences between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? And whoever feels like they've got the best answer wins.
Well, I don't know if we win. I think we're about equal. But definitely, that's probably one of the most common questions we get at the Alzheimer's Association is just what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia, especially since those terms are used so interchangeably all of the time. I think that adds to confusion for many people when they hear it. I think the most important thing for people to keep in mind about that term dementia is that it is an umbrella term that refers to changes in memory, thinking, and reasoning that are interfering with somebody's ability to take care of themselves on a day-to-day basis. But it's just talking about the symptoms that that person is experiencing. It is not a specific disease and is not a specific diagnosis. And as you mentioned, Alzheimer's is the most common form that there is. It's important for people to understand that Alzheimer's is not a normal part of the aging process. It's progressive, and it does continue to get worse over time. It is caused by abnormal proteins that begin to form in the brain that are called plaques and tangles. Most people have probably heard of plaques and tangles associated with Alzheimer's disease. But those abnormal proteins actually cause brain cells to die and for the brain begin to shrink. And that's when we start to see those symptoms that come from dementia that we talked about. So I always say that the term dementia is a little bit like the word cancer. So when we hear that cancer, what's one of the very first questions we ask people? What kind do they have, right?
Yeah.
And when we know what kind of cancer someone has, we understand what part of the body is affected. We may understand what kind of symptoms they have. We may understand how it might progress. We understand how it might be treated. So when we find out that someone has dementia, we should be asking that very same question. What kind do they have? Because when we understand what kind of dementia someone has, whether it's Alzheimer's or one of the other types, we are better able to understand the symptoms that that person person is experiencing, and we are better able to understand how that disease might progress, we can understand better what sort of things we may do to assist that person and provide better care to them over time when we understand that diagnosis for that person. So it is really important for people to understand that Alzheimer's and dementia are not the same thing, and that we really need to be finding out what's going on for them.
And, you know, when it comes to your resources and support, I was really focusing on the Alzheimer's piece of it because you are the Alzheimer's Association. But do you still offer the same resources or support regardless of the specific diagnosis?
Yes, actually, our full legal name is Alzheimer's Disease and Related Disorders Association, but that's really a mouthful. I'll try to say that four times real fast. That and the fact that Alzheimer's is the most common, but we do work with anyone who's facing any type of dementia, regardless of what diagnosis they have.
Gotcha. So the first thing that you think of when you think of Alzheimer's or dementia is, of course, memory loss, or at least to me. What are some of the other symptoms that people should be looking out for?
I'll take this one.
Okay.
So things that we also, you know, people always say, well, you know, I've just started noticing changes. I always tell them, think of, like, let's take July 4th. What was this person able to do on July 4th? And now they're not able. So maybe all of a sudden they're not keeping appointments. They're having more trouble with communication, jumbling words, having more problems managing a checkbook, planning, organizing. All these little subtle changes really are clues that something is happening. Keeping track of their medications, recalling familiar people. You know, we sometimes say, oh, they just forgot it. But keep track, like if there's more things happening and things have changed, you know, from this one period to now, you know that something is happening, something is going on. It's a good way to just take note.
Well, and I like that idea of keep track, because then you have that actually, you know, written down where you can take that mm-hmm. to a professional. And later on, I'm going to ask some questions about, you know, getting the diagnosis and talking to a loved one about the diagnosis. And I think if you have that written down in black and white, that would probably be helpful for everyone involved. So I know when it comes to dementia, a lot of times, I hate to say this, it starts out to people as being almost funny, right? Up until it's not. Where's my key? You know, I think at a young age, we all start making those references to dementia. But I know when we get back, I want to ask what the diagnosis process is and if it's actually hard to get the diagnosis. So hold that thought until after the break, and we're going to take a look at what the diagnosis process looks like and some of the resources out there. My guest today is Julie St. Pierre and Jennifer Nowak from the Wisconsin chapter of Alzheimer's Association. When we return, like I said, we're going to discuss the diagnosis process and then also some prevention options, treatments, and treatments for Alzheimer's. Sorry, that was a mouthful. Stay tuned after this break.
Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy.
Hard is a long-standing tradition in Wisconsin. Some of the first labor unions formed here because of it. This Labor Day, join Earl Ingram as he hosts a special The Earl Ingram Show live from 8 to 11 a.m. at Labor Fest in Milwaukee.
Many people don't work on Labor Day, and so all they know is it's a day off. As a person who spent 34 years in labor and was a union man, I know the value of that.
Earl and his guests will discuss how Wisconsin's labor-related legislation legislation became a model for other states, along with what unions look like now.
I've seen us go from that 30% union membership to now in Wisconsin, somewhere around 12%.
A union-led parade meets up with festgoers on the Summerfest grounds at 11. Laborfest is free and open to all. Join Earl Ingram live this Labor Day, Monday, September 4th, starting at 8 a.m. from Laborfest in Milwaukee, only here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, can potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the world...
You are listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show, and I am your host, Liza Hellenbrand, and I've been talking with Julie St. Pierre and Jennifer Nowak from the Wisconsin Chapter Alzheimer's Association. And before the break, I was just about to ask about the diagnosis process. So I know, you know, for a lot of people, it starts out as a joke, or, you know, they write it off. It could be stress or lack of sleep or too many things going on in any given day. But I'm curious, is it actually hard to get a diagnosis?
Well, I think the only way that we can know with 100% certainty that somebody has Alzheimer's is by looking at their brain tissue once they've passed away in an autopsy process. But right now, with the tools that we have available, we're about 90 to 95% accurate in diagnosing Alzheimer's. It can be a little bit tricky. Like you mentioned, sometimes people just think, oh, I'm just getting older, and they kind of dismiss those earliest signs as just part of getting older and memory changes. And sometimes that even happens when they bring the concerns to the doctor. The doctor will say something to the tune of, well, you are 85. Yeah. Things are bound to change. So I always encourage families to be advocates for themselves and their loved ones when they're concerned about something. Typically, people start with their primary care physician and do, have a conversation about what they're noticing. Usually, the primary care provider will rule out some reversible and treatable things that may be causing memory problems, you know, such as depression, undiagnosed, untreated sleep disorders, nutritional issues, medication interactions, other illnesses like a urinary tract infection. But once we've kind of hit that wall where we've kind of ruled everything out that we think could be causing problems, typically there's a referral to some sort of a specialist, such as a neurologist or a memory diagnostic center. Process, what that typically looks like for folks is that they look at the person's medical history, they'll do a physical exam, they take into consideration past and current medical conditions, they'll review medications, talk about alcohol use, tobacco use, family history of dementia. And with the patient's permission, one of the things that's really key to the diagnosis is input from close family and friends who may be noticing those changes. Because if someone's experiencing memory loss themselves, they're not always the most accurate reporter as to exactly what they're remembering or not remembering. So that's part of the problem, right?
Right.
So they'll also do labs. Some blood work may be done just to look at vitamins and hormone levels. Depression screening is part of that. But the most important piece is the neuropsychological testing that gets done. And in a nutshell, what that is exercising the brain from the top to the bottom, the front to the back, using different types of games, puzzles, exercises, and seeing which parts of the brain are working like they're supposed to and which parts maybe aren't working quite so great. What that pattern on that testing will show is what's working, what's not, and that's how they then make a diagnosis as to what they think is causing the problem. So it is a little bit of a tedious process. It's time consuming. It's not something that will happen in a 10-minute appointment with your provider. But there certainly are, like I mentioned, experts, neurologists, memory centers that can help with that.
That is so interesting. So on average, how long, if you know, does the process take from somebody being concerned to seeing their primary physician to getting to the point where they take some of this cognitive testing and, you know, get a diagnosis?
It sometimes can take several months from the time someone first raises that concern with their primary physician to actually going through the testing process. Part of that, again, is comprehensive. They'll also do brain imaging. And so all of these pieces take time. I sort of use the analogy of it's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. You're taking all of these different pieces and you're putting them together to get a picture as to what you think is going on. And just like it takes a little bit of time to put that jigsaw puzzle together, it takes time to put the pieces of that diagnosis together as well.
That makes total sense. And the reason that I do the Empowered Caregiver is I have a son actually that's on the autism spectrum. So it kind of reminds me of that. It can be a process. When I first took him to see my primary physician, he said, oh, no way. He smiles. He makes eye contact. You know, he just totally dismissed me. So there was some advocating and, you know, even getting the appointment times to see those professionals can go out months. So if you have concerns, start with your primary physician is what
correct.
I'm hearing. Okay. And yeah. Then I believe that Medicaid currently does not cover Alzheimer's assessments. Is this correct? And if so, why is that a problem?
Well, for most people, when it comes to an Alzheimer's diagnosis, the issue will be Medicare and private insurance, and they do cover the testing. There's never been any issues with that. As far as Medicaid, I would just encourage people, I will be candid and admit what I don't know, and that's one thing that I don't know. However, I think the important thing, starting with that primary care physician to get the initial appointment, and then go through the appropriate referral process for additional testing. So usually the primary will then make a referral to a specialist. And usually it's that referral process, if that doesn't get followed, that typically you run into issues where maybe something isn't covered, but that referral process can be really important.
Gotcha. And I had another host on a few weeks ago, and she said that she went to the local ADRC, Aging and Disability Resource Center, and they did a dementia assessment there. Are you familiar with how the local ADRCs can help you and your loved one in this process?
Yeah, actually, we work really closely with our ADRCs, our county ADRCs, and especially the dementia care specialists. And the assessment that you're talking about is actually a community memory screening. So they screen, and if there's any concerns or things that come up, they actually refer you back to your doctor and go through the process that Julie was just talking about.
Okay.
So it's really a screening, and it's very popular. Many communities have these screenings just to help people identify and encourage them to go for these further testing.
Wonderful. I've been talking with Julie and Jennifer from the Wisconsin chapter.
From I-43 to I-41, this is the Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. President Biden and the First Lady head to Florida today to survey the damage from Hurricane Idalia. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis says he has no plans to meet with the president. It's expected to be a busy holiday travel weekend. If you haven't hit the road yet, consider
the best and worst times to travel. Today, the heaviest traffic will be between 10 this morning and 6 tonight. For your trip home Monday, AAA says if you don't want to be in the thick of it, travel after 7 p.m.
ABC's Phil Lipoff. Some 14 million Americans expected to be screened at airports this holiday weekend. Singer, songwriter, and restaurateur Jimmy Buffett has died. A statement on his website says he died peacefully, surrounded by family, friends, music, and dogs. He was 76. In the first papal visit to Mongolia ever, Pope Francis celebrating the country's growing Catholic community. Francis praised Mongolia's long history of religious freedom dating back to Genghis Khan. This is ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Bandana, check. Boots, check. Gloves, check. As a motorcycle rider in Wisconsin, you may go to great lengths to protect your image. Just be sure you're protecting yourself, too. Wear a Department of Transportation-approved helmet. Perform safety checks on your motorcycle. Know the traffic laws and don't take risks. Motorists and motorcyclists can work together to achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roads. Zero in Wisconsin. Together, we can save lives. Learn more at zeroinwisconsin.gov.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
Working hard is a long-standing tradition in Wisconsin. Some of the first labor unions formed here because of it. This Labor Day, join Earl Ingram as he hosts a special The Earl Ingram Show, live from 8 to 11 a.m. at Labor Fest in Milwaukee.
Many people don't work on Labor Day, and so all they know is it's a day off. As a person who spent 34 years in labor and was a union man, I know the value of that.
Earl and his guests will discuss how Wisconsin's labor-related legislation became a model for other states, along with what unions look like now.
I've seen us go from that 30% union membership to now in Wisconsin, somewhere around 12%.
A union-led parade meets up with festgoers on the Summerfest grounds at 11. Labor Fest is free and open to all. Join Earl Ingram live this Labor Day, Monday, September 4th, starting at 8 a.m. from Labor Fest in Milwaukee. Only here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app. We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the kiddie rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kiddie rides. I love to put a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away.
You are listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show, and I'm your host, Liza Hallenbrand, and I've been talking with Julie St. Pierre and Jennifer Nowak from the Alzheimer's Association, the Wisconsin chapter. And I started the show talking about the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia, or what Alzheimer's is in dementia, and then where to go from help and some of the process of getting the diagnosis. So if you missed out on that, valuable information was shared. So you can go back and listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Just search for the Empowered Caregiver. And since this show supports family caregivers, I really want to discuss caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. And I apologize, ladies. I'm kind of a statistic and fact nerd, so I have a few things that I just need to throw out there because they are really eye-opening and just goes to show, you know, how important your organization is and having conversations like this are. So more than 11 million people in the U.S. provide some form of unpaid care to someone with Alzheimer's or dementia. One study found people with dementia require 151 hours of caregiving per month on the onset of dementia, increasing to 283 hours per month up to 8 years later, which comes out to over 65 hours a week in unpaid care. In 2021, the lifetime care cost for a person with dementia was over $377,000, with 41% of us, the caregivers, having a household income of $50,000 or less. So if I'm understanding this correctly, if my parent or loved one gets diagnosed with Alzheimer's, if I have about $400,000 sitting in my bank, then I'm pretty okay, right? But otherwise, I need to roll up my sleeve. Well, either way, right? Either way, you're going to be impacted. But it is a huge responsibility and a huge emotional toll that it takes on the caregiver. And I feel like this is a role that you really need to prepare yourself for. I can't imagine going through this without some knowledge and resources. What does the Alzheimer's Association offer as far as support goes, and how can people connect with you?
Sure. I think one of my greatest fears is meeting someone after they've been a caregiver and have them say, "Where were you guys while I was taking care of my mom?" And so I appreciate opportunities like this to share what we do. So hopefully we catch people while they're caregiving or before they're caregiving.
Sure.
Probably the most important service that the Alzheimer's Association provides and the easiest way for people to connect with us is through our 24/7 helpline. And that's at 1-800-272-3900. Because as you mentioned, Liza, people are providing a lot of care. And it's important for them to have access to help and support when they have the time to get that help and support, which may be at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's where things like our 24/7 helpline can come in handy if they just need someone to talk to. Or if they have specific questions that they need to have addressed, that helpline is there. You mentioned our amazing website. It's a little bit of a rabbit hole. Like, you can get sucked in and spend 2 hours and have no idea where the time went. Mm-hmm. There are you know, things you can read. There are classes that you can take that are virtual and on demand. So I would encourage people, if that's what they have the time for, take some time to explore that website and learn about the disease. A couple of the more personalized services that the association provides are, one is care consultations, providing individualized support and disease education, helping people with understanding decision-making and planning. We offer support groups, a wide variety of support groups across the state. Some of them are virtual. Many of them are in person, designed to meet different caregiving needs related to specific diagnosis, what stage of the disease someone is in. Those support groups are available, so we can help them, whether they reach out to us through our helpline or through our local offices. We can help connect them with those support groups. And then community and education programs. We offer a variety of evidence-informed classes that help to provide skill building and awareness. So maybe it's just understanding the disease, or maybe it's specific to caregivers and it helps them build the skills they need to take care of their loved one. I can't emphasize enough that connecting is really important.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I love how you have things broken down in the stages because Alzheimer's progresses in stages. So if you're not able to take it in all at once, you know, start with stage one, or, and, you know, it gives you the opportunity to learn what you need to prepare for next. And like you said, staying connected is so important. And I know, you know, from my personal family background, growing up in a small rural community, support groups was probably something that my family would not join. But I think that they can be invaluable. You know, some of it is they can't justify the time, and some of it is just feeling uncomfortable. But why do you guys think that support groups are valuable, and why do you think people should really not hesitate to consider them?
Really, it comes down to the insight that you gain from support groups. And so you don't feel that you're not alone. The information that is shared and the techniques that are shared, it helps the whole group. As Julie mentioned, our support groups are both virtual and in person. So we have five virtual support groups that are across the state of Wisconsin. So you have people from every area of Wisconsin joining in. I also think it's really great for virtual programming that if, in case you're not the person that wants to stand up and tell your story, you're able to sit back a little and just gain the knowledge of your partners. I guess that's what I have found so interesting. Julie and I both do support groups. And I guess the interesting part is because it's virtual, we're having people from other states come in and give their perspective of what's happening in their state. So it's just such a valuable resource. And they're offered all different times, in person and virtually across the state.
Well, and I like that, absorb the information, because like you said, you know, if you are like myself, an introvert of a person, and you don't feel comfortable sharing your emotions and what you're going through, you just sit back and learn what other people are doing. There's so many, you know, resources and other connections that can be made. So I encourage everyone to check that out. A question that I like to ask everyone is, what are three things that you wish all caregivers starting this particular journey knew?
I'm going to piggyback on everything that Julie said. Educate yourself on the disease process, what's next, start, you know, planning. The great thing about getting a diagnosis and an early diagnosis is you can start planning for your future, the financial, the legal, as you talked about, you know, who is going to care for me? There's so much information. So educate yourself, plan, and then connect yourself to the Alzheimer's Association. You know, whether you hit us in the middle, you know, all the different stages, you can come back in and out, and it's a great way to help you through the whole process.
Well, and you know, in the beginning part of that process would be, one, as a caregiver or a loved one, you know, starting that conversation. If you have a parent, mm-hmm. or somebody that you're concerned about that's displaying signs of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, do you have resources about how to start that conversation, or do you have any personal advice that you would give?
Well, the Alzheimer's Association actually has a program called Dementia Conversations, and that's precisely how do you have some of these tough conversations with people about the signs and symptoms that you're seeing and getting them to actually go to the doctor. The biggest piece of advice that I have for families when it comes to having this conversation is to try to keep it as positive as possible. And how do we do that? Well, you may start noticing signs and symptoms in someone, but instead of saying, hey, you know, I think you might have Alzheimer's, we ought to go to the doctor. That's really scary, right? You've already put that A word out there. Try to come at it from a positive approach of, you know what, there's so many things that can affect our memory functions as we get older. Maybe we ought to get this looked at and just see if it's the medication you're taking. Something that's a more positive approach to getting them to want to go to the doctor. Telling them, I just want to make sure that your memory is as sharp as it can be and that we're doing anything and everything we could do to keep you healthy and independent. I know, speaking from personal, you know, my personal feeling, I would be much more likely to be receptive to seeking a diagnosis if someone was selling it to me from that positive, like, we just want to make sure you're getting taken care of and can stay independent. So that's the big piece of advice that I give to folks, is try to keep it as positive as you can when you have that tough conversation with them.
I love that. And I loved how you explained it, because when you said keep it positive, I'm thinking, okay, Julie, tell me more. How do we keep Alzheimer's positive again? But really, you know what? Maybe it's something else. I'm worried about your health, in not saying, I think that you may have this. So I love that. And I love that you have the resources to really prepare people for that, because that can be a very tough conversation. Another thing that I saw on your website under the caregivers resources is Lots of Helping Hands, which helps caregivers create care teams. Can you explain what this means and why care teams are important?
Oh,
That's okay.
this is going to be a passing question, but we really talk about building a care team,
okay,
and the importance of that. So one of the first things we want people to do is start developing your care team. So when you talk about educating yourself and things you need to start doing, it's building your care support team. We call it contingency planning for the future. Who is going to be with you, not just now, but who's going to be with you in the future, to be that advocate for you, know your wishes, and is going to be willing to step forward and help you through the process. So it could be medical professionals, it could be a sister or a brother, it could be a friend. So it starts to get that team together, you know, building who is going to be your support person, and to start having those conversations. What do you want them to know? What do you want in your future when you might not be able to make those decisions or verbalize those decisions? And have a meeting, you know, start having meetings, and you might want a professional there to help guide those meetings and have things written down so people know what your wishes are in the future. So there's no questions. Oh, we really feel that is important.
Yeah, that is. And I didn't even think about that aspect of really talking to the person that's diagnosed early on, while they can, you know, still consider some of their wants and their wishes and advocate for themselves. I know with some families that probably does get a little sticky. Are there people that you recommend to, if you need that mediator or that, you know, that person to facilitate that conversation?
That's where we use the care consults. You know, we try to help the individual identify who is your support system. And, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes they'll say, you know, my cousin Jeannie, but after talking to Jeannie's not really going to be the one that's going to follow through. So it's starting to pick your team and then start interviewing them and making your wishes known, and see if your gut feeling is still the same after it's through.
And that is something, that is a service then that you guys provide.
Yes, we can definitely do a care consult. Yes.
Oh, and help. Wonderful. That is wonderful. We have one more segment where we can talk a little bit more about the wonderful work that the Alzheimer's Association, the Wisconsin chapter, is doing.
Made that no one can deny.
so unforgettable, thinks that I am unforgettable too.
You are listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show, and I am your host, Eliza Hallenbrand. Today, I've been talking with Julie St. Pierre and Jennifer Nowak from the Alzheimer's Association, the Wisconsin chapter, and we have just 8 short minutes left and so many questions, but there was one that I wanted to ask earlier, actually 2, that I just want to go back to. On the website, I saw that the FDA has approved 7 drugs for treating Alzheimer's disease. 5 of these drugs aim to improve the symptoms, while 2 of them aim to change the underlying biology of the disease. Is medication typically the first step for everyone diagnosed with Alzheimer's? And in what ways can medication help?
So medications are something that obviously there's been some exciting news, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But I think it's really up to patients to talk with their primary providers about the medications available. As you mentioned, a couple are meant, 5 of them actually work just by helping to stabilize some of the symptoms someone might be experiencing, but they don't work for everyone. And it's hard to know who they're going to work for or not without taking them. And so I always tell people, have a conversation with your doctor, weigh the pros and cons, and see if you'd like to give those medications a try. Those medications don't modify the disease. They just help with managing the symptoms. Exciting this year were 2 new medications that are disease modifying in that they affect. I had talked earlier about the plaques and tangles. They actually target the amyloid plaques that form in the brain. However, these medications are extremely cost prohibitive, and they are not really very accessible for most folks. They're very hard to administer and require a lot of supervision, including regular infusions, monitoring through MRIs. And so they really are not accessible to most folks at this point. But I do feel that if people are interested in learning about the medications, they should talk to their doctor, talk about what their specific diagnosis is and whether their provider feels that those medications could be helpful for them.
And outside of medications, are there non-drug forms of treatment that people can do to support their loved ones?
Yeah, there's we call them non-pharmaceutical approaches to managing behavioral symptoms, such as they promote the physical and the emotional comfort of an individual, whether it be, changing the environment, redirecting them. It's really about looking for other ways besides a medication to help ease their pain.
Gotcha. And then, there is one other question. Outside of age, genetics, and of course, family history, are there things that we can be doing or not doing to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia altogether?
Yeah, we have this great form, the 10 Ways to Love Your Brain, and we do promote that statewide. It's never too late to start. You're never too young, never too old, and, no smoking. The short version of this is, what's good for your heart is good for your brain. Exercise, eating the right foods, getting enough sleep, challenging yourself, to build up your brain, breaking a sweat, exercising, hitting the books, education they're finding. Adult education is so positive to keeping your brain healthy. So yeah, there's 10 steps to loving your brain.
And I've got to assume that would be on your website
right? It's a great form. I could have went more in detail. I know we're out of time, but yes.
Well, you can check it out. Why don't I have you guys give the website? I don't even know if we put that out there. What is the website address where people can find you?
Well, the Alzheimer's Association is alz.org. If you're looking specifically for Wisconsin, alz.org/WI, and that will bring you right to our chapter.
Gotcha. In addition to all of the support and resources that the Alzheimer's Association provides. They also fund research in an aggressive pursuit of its vision of a world without Alzheimer's. The Alzheimer's Association made its largest research investment ever in 2021, granting more than $70 million to 253 scientific investigations. They're also leading the way in the reduction and early detection and raising awareness about Alzheimer's as well as maximizing the quality of care and support. Can you tell listeners about some of the fundraisers that you do, where they can go to learn more, and other ways that they can get involved?
Sure. Well, I want to toot our horn just a little bit more and actually let you know that some of the research that the Alzheimer's Association funds is actually happening right here in Wisconsin.
Wonderful.
So that is super exciting for us to be able to share that. One of the biggest events that the Alzheimer's Association does is the Walk to End Alzheimer's, and that actually happens in 600 cities across the country, including 27 right here in Wisconsin. And that is our largest fundraiser. And if people are interested in learning about how to get more information and get involved, it's super easy through our website, alz.org/walk. And then once they are on that website, there's a little bar that says find the event closest to you. You type in your city and zip code, and it'll bring you to the event that's closest to you. You can also look if you have a home community somewhere further away that you'd like to go to. You can find that one as well.
And they're all coming up. It was very easy to find, and I saw that they were going on through September and October, a lot of them. So check that out. What other ways can they support you and get involved?
So if you're not a walker, there's also an event called The Longest Day. You can get more information at alz.org/TLD for TLD for Longest Day. And that's a more focuses on the longest day of the year, the summer solstice, but activities for that happen all year round. And it's kind of a design your own event. So it can be something that's near and dear to your heart. We have a family that geocaches every year. They start geocaching at sunrise and they stop at sunset and they gather pledges throughout the day through their website. And that's what they do for fundraising on the Longest Day. I'd be remiss, though, in not putting a little plug in for the fact that we also utilize volunteers through our care and support program as well. So if you're not a fundraiser, but you're interested in getting involved on our care and support side, we're always looking for community educators, support group facilitators, community representatives, anything you might be interested in, we could probably use you as a volunteer. So reach out to us.
Definitely lots of opportunities to serve, learn, grow, and meet other folks in your community. Thank you, Jennifer and Julie, for being with me tonight and sharing the information that you did and the work that you do. It is so needed and so appreciated, and you have to be just an extremely valuable resource to so many Wisconsinites throughout the state. So thank you.
Thanks for inviting us. Yes, thank you for letting us share our information.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. Take care.
Okay.
Now I am older.
ABC News, I'm